Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. We are joined now by Andrew McAfee, a principal research scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business, and Eric Brynjolfsson, director of the Center for Digital Business and a professor at MIT's Sloan School. Together, they are the authors of Race Against the Machine, a book which argues that the fundamental market for labor may be changing, that high unemployment and long-term unemployment may not be a short-term problem, and that computers increasingly are displacing humans. Their controversial thesis has been examined in the New York Times, The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and many others. Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to start you off first with a scene which probably you and I have seen many, many times, where you walk into CVS or Walgreens or into your local supermarket, and many lines, sometimes all the checkout lines, are automated. So there's nobody standing at them, but you can check yourself out. And I wonder, when you see that, what it indicates to you about the direction that we're going in.
Sure. That is a perfect example of how technology is automating and replacing a lot of jobs, especially those that are relatively routine, low and middle skill jobs are especially vulnerable. I was just looking at some data from LinkedIn, and they're looking at the most common job titles that have seen growth in the past 5 years and those that have seen declines. Sales associate was the number one declining job category, down almost 35% in the past 4 years, more than the rest of the population.
And one of the reasons we should pay some attention to that is that it's historically been a very, very large job category. The retail industry has employed a lot of people in the U.S.
So, but all right, let me play devil's advocate here. Isn't it good, in a sense, that really low-wage, generally no-benefit jobs are disappearing, perhaps freeing people up to do jobs that have more value to them?
Well, that's not devil's advocate. That's economist advocate.
Yeah. which may or may not be the same thing.
So you're absolutely right. Productivity is a good thing. And as we say in the book, it's terrific that technology is advancing and allowing us to have more wealth with less work. The problem is that there's no economic law that everyone has to benefit evenly from this improvement. Although we've created trillions of dollars of wealth in the past decade, much of it technology driven, a lot of people have been left behind. And so the median wage, the median income, the person at the 50th percentile has actually fallen behind, we're making less now than they did before, even though our GDP per capita, the amount of wealth overall, is growing quite rapidly. And that reflects the kinds of technologies that you just described. That are replacing sales associates, routine clerical jobs, and a lot of other mid-skill professions, hollowing out the labor force, even as it amplifies the value of some of the jobs that require special skills. Big data analysts right now, you know, can name their price. They take some of that data from those kiosks you were just describing, crunch the numbers, and they identify opportunities for making the products or services more profitable. So some people are benefiting tremendously and other people aren't.
And it's also true that all of us are benefiting from the fact that CVS gets to charge lower prices because they've got automated checkout stations. And as those big data geeks go to work and derive insight, they're going to figure out new things that we might want in convenience stores, supermarkets, airports, things like that. But the phenomena on the flip side of that coin, productivity growth is a great thing. It's the single most important statistic for an economy. The flip side of it, though, is, as Eric says, that there's no iron law that we all benefit equally. And some folk are finding that the skills that they have to offer the workforce are not nearly as highly valued, especially as technology keeps on demonstrating its ability to do new things. In this case, check us out of a convenience store.
So do you fundamentally see this as an education divide, where if you have an education, very often you can get the kind of jobs that are harder to replace. And if you don't have one, you're dealing with the sales clerk job that is being easily replaced by a computer.
Education is absolutely one of the key differentiators what economists call skill-biased technical change has been getting more and more severe in recent years. That is, technology biased towards more educated people and biased against people with less education. But it's not just education. There's at least three sets of winners and losers that we talk about in the book. One, as we mentioned, is skilled versus less skilled workers. Another one is superstars versus everyone else, because it's not just the college graduates who are benefiting. It's really disproportionately the top 1% or even the top 1/100 of 1% that have gotten the lion's shares of benefits. 93% of the income gains in the past 2 years went to the top 1%.
Why is that?
It's because technology allows people with talents and skills to leverage those talents and skills across hundreds of millions of consumers, or even billions of consumers in some cases. Some obvious examples in music and entertainment, where Lady Gaga can replicate, or people like you who can reach millions of people through the radio. Some less obvious but also important ones are in the software industry. Mark Zuckerberg, when he developed some wonderful new software, or Scott Cook may develop better tax software. At the same time, that's replacing a lot of pretty good tax accountants who really aren't as necessary anymore. It's even happening, we're seeing in finance, and CEOs of companies are also finding that their skills are leveraged over much broader groups. And the third group of winners and losers, just to mention that for completeness, is between capital and labor. It's sort of obvious when you think about it, but the technology allows you to replace a lot of workers with robots and machines. And when it does that, more of the wealth is created by capital and less by labor. Now, of course, the machines themselves don't get paid. They don't earn paychecks, but the owners of those machines do. And those are often different people than the workers usually are. In fact, all three of these different sets of winners and losers all skew in the same direction, where the richer, wealthier people are earning, capturing a bigger share of the productive output of the economy. And the rest of the people in the economy aren't getting as big a share.
And Kara, you asked a question about education, and Eric answered a question about skills. And I find that really interesting, because we assume that those two are really, really tightly coupled, and that the way that you are going to succeed in today's economy and tomorrow's economy is by getting more education. I want to be careful with that. The way you're going to succeed is by having skills that machines don't have and aren't going to acquire anytime soon. That's not exactly the same thing as going back to school, getting more education, getting another degree. And one of the weirdest phenomena that we're observing these days is some incredibly highly educated professions being deeply affected by automation. And as an example there, one of the ones we talk about in the book is the profession of law, which has historically been a very well compensated, very highly educated one. And now we have things like e-discovery software, which are doing a pretty good job of replacing that room full of lawyers who used to sit around and read boxes of documents as part of a legal process. There are also areas of medicine that we think are going to be pretty deeply affected by technology, in particular different flavors of diagnosis. A flip way to say it is, take Watson, which is the Jeopardy-winning supercomputer developed by IBM.
Let me stop you there. We have a clip of Watson on Jeopardy competing against Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings in early 2011, and it was IBM's chance to show what a computer can do. Let's listen to it.
Olympic oddities for 400.
In 1908, in this city, U.S. flag bearer Ralph Rose caused controversy by not lowering the flag when passing the king. Watson?
What is London?
Correct.
Andrew McAfee, we saw him just blow away people who had been multi-million dollar champions on Jeopardy. Yeah.
And Ken Jennings appears to have been engineered from birth to play the game of Jeopardy. He was a machine, and Watson wound up with three times as much money as Ken did. And with that clip, look at the skills that Watson was demonstrating. It could produce human speech. Okay, that's kind of cool. It could understand human speech. It could understand a question asked in that kind of convoluted Jeopardy way to realize that it was asking for a city. It could then query this massive, massive base of documents that it was sitting on top of. And it was not connected to the internet. It had its own repository of just text information, it could extract the answer to a very weird question from that mass, do it in real time, and feed it back quicker than Ken Jennings could. This is a bundle of skills that are very, very new for computers. It starts to feel a lot like science fiction, and this, we're really outstripping our previous understanding of what computers were good at versus what they weren't good at.
And this is a great example of not just a computer that plays Jeopardy, but as Andy was alluding to, IBM is using this technology in all sorts of areas now, in law, in medicine. Watson has been hired on Wall Street now to help them analyze documents and answer questions in call centers as well. Dave Ferrucci, the father of Watson, came to MIT and spoke at our class and described how this technology worked. And one of the most remarkable charts he put up, which I'll describe to you, was one where he showed the sort of frontier of Watson's capabilities in terms of the types of questions it could answer and how quickly and accurately it could advance. And when they first started 6 years ago, it was nowhere close to even just an average human being. But what you saw is every 6 months they'd come out with another iteration and that frontier would advance. And by the time he came to our class, it had passed most of the Jeopardy champions. Ken Jennings was still this little dot up in the upper right corner, still able to beat the best iteration of Watson at that point. But you could tell just by the relentless progress of the technology that it wouldn't be long before he passed Ken Jennings. And of course he did
a few months later. He creamed him.
And they're not stopping. I mean, they're continuing to advance. But it's something that Andy and I are calling second half technologies. These technologies that are almost magical that 8 or 10 years ago we couldn't have imagined would have happened. But now, whether it's Watson or Siri or Google's autonomous car or many other applications, robotics, we're seeing things that are just leaps and bounds ahead of anything that people would have predicted.
Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson, stand by. We'll be right back, and I want to talk about this idea of computers getting into these really high-skilled professions and really who couldn't be replaced by a computer. Remember that you can find us on the web at wgbh.org/innovationhub or on Twitter at WGBHInnovate. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.